things like HTTPS are now everywhere, that Google is securing email between itself and the other major email providers, that a lot of the passive methods that the NSA used 10 years ago aren't working today. Now, the flip side of this is corporate surveillance has gone, you know, from 0 to 60 over those 10 years. And now, if you are a government and you want to surveil somebody, you tell Facebook to tell you what they know about them, or Google, or Apple, or any of those companies.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, we discuss hacking. Wendy Grossman joins the Plutopians as we interview author Bruce Snyder. Bruce's new book, A Hacker's Mind, explores hacking in all of its many forms.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest edition of the Plutopia podcast. Writer, blogger, and author Wendy Grossman, author of NetWars, joins Plutopians for a conversation with Bruce Snyder, an internationally renowned computer security professional and author. Bruce's latest book, A Hacker's Mind, How the Powerful Bend Society's Rules and How to Bend Them Back, is an expanded view of hacks and hackers beyond computers to other kinds of systems, from tax laws to financial markets to politics. And now Wendy will open with a question.
Wow, it sounds like a formal hearing. This is exciting.
I know, it's frightening.
You have 2 minutes. You can give them back to the chair if you like.
Actually, I know you want to talk about your book. I'm sure you're not sick of talking about your book. But I thought we could start actually by the thing that is occupying the press this week, which is Snowden plus 10 years. And most of the discussion focuses on, do we have more surveillance and did we do anything useful like pass a law? But the thing that interests me is the technical efforts to harden the internet against passive monitoring, which is regarded as an attack on the internet. In February 2014, I went to a workshop run by the Internet Engineering Task Force and the World Wide Web Consortium that began the work of trying to come up with ways to harden the internet against pervasive surveillance. And when I called, one of the people who organized, who was involved, who got me my place at that workshop was Steve Belevin, the security engineer. And I called him yesterday and he pointed me at the draft document that you and he and a couple of others wrote. And so I thought that would be an interesting place to start in that, you know, how much have we succeeded in fending, you know, making it harder and more expensive for people like the NSA to snoop on all of us?
Now, it's interesting. So that's a piece that some of us are writing in 10 years after Snowden.
I read your piece.
And my particular piece, but the people listening might not have. But
yes.
My particular contribution was a piece I actually wrote at the time that was never published for a variety of reasons. So I have a little time capsule on there. Steve writes a lot more about the efforts of the IETF to secure the internet. And I think reading it, it largely is a success story, that things like HTTPS are now everywhere, that Google is securing email between itself and the other major email providers, that a lot of the passive methods that the NSA used 10 years ago aren't working today. Now, the flip side of this is corporate surveillance has gone, you know, from 0 to 60. Over those 10 years. And now if you are a government and you want to surveil somebody, you tell Facebook to tell you what they know about them, or Google or Apple or any of those companies. So, you know, there's good and there's bad here. We can look at our successes. And I remember an IETF meeting in, I think it was Vancouver, in the first few months after the Snowden revelations first appeared. And the indignation in the room, and we must do something. We did a lot. And I think what we missed is surveillance as a business model.
Yeah.
That in fact, these companies who are making their living spying on everything about us are going to respond to any legitimate court order because they have to. And that's not just US, that's, you know, many countries around the world.
Yeah, I mean, there was a case earlier this year, I think, where Facebook turned over messages between a mother and daughter who were planning to get her an abortion or something like that, and everybody was outraged that they turned it over. But there was a, you know, there was a court order and a warrant, and you know, the rest of the time we're saying, well, Facebook should obey the law.
Right.
So, you
And this is
know.
the problem. The problem is not face problem here. I mean, two things. One is that that is a reasonable thing for the government to do. And two, that Facebook has that data in the first place,
Right.
right? To turn it over, that, you know, we could decide to design these systems so that data isn't stored.
Right.
So that when the courts go to Facebook and say, turn over this data, Facebook says, I'm sorry, I don't have it.
Or that it could be encrypted messaging, and then even though they get the messages, they can't read the content.
That's the same thing as I don't have it, right?
Yeah.
I don't have it
Yeah.
in plain text. I don't have it in anything in a useful form that you can use, right? We can design these systems, but we don't do that because these systems are designed for the near-term financial interest of Facebook and for no other reason.
And also, you know, I've thought for years that one reason governments don't generally, I mean, the EU being an exception, I guess, that governments don't generally really want to stop the collection of data because, as you say, then they have it's something they can access if they want it.
Right. They want it too. And this is true whether you're the US or the EU or China. I mean, your goals might be different, but your methods are going to be the same. Right? The companies scoop it up in you know, all the normal ways that we interact with each other using these platforms. And it is available to government when government says, you know, we want it. You know, back 10 years ago, there were talks about retention laws forcing companies to save the data. You know, what we
Oh, the
didn't
EU,
count
in
on
fact,
is that
yeah.
Moore's law made those irrelevant, that in fact companies are now saving it all forever because it's cheaper than throwing it away. And now with the rise of these AI systems that need this data for training, suddenly it's valuable.
Actually, what Snowden showed us that the NSA had done is the kind of hack you talk about in your book. Which is, you know, we had a big public debate about encryption. A conclusion was reached. And then, you know, as I said at the time, then the NSA cheated. You know,
Yeah,
you know.
and that's our,
And
and I
that's.
say that too, right? And that's our definition of what cheating is, right? They found a loophole in the rules that allowed them to basically say one thing and do another. And this is not an uncommon way that the powerful cheat, that the powerful subvert the rules. It is what I write about. And yeah, it's interesting to think about now. Is Snowden's stuff was over 10 years old. It was 2 years old or so, you know, when he published it 10 years ago. So let's say it's a
Right.
dozen years old. NSA's had a dozen years to invent and develop and field and test and iterate on new things. So what they're doing now, you know, I don't think we really have any idea of.
No, I mean.
Probably they are using the corporate feeds. I mean, this was in 10 years ago, right? Like, you know, can we tap into Google? Can we tap into these systems? So I'm sure they're doing that still. I'm sure they're relying on, you know, what we saw in 2014, the 2013, the Verizon order, right? Forcing Verizon to turn over all their cell phone metadata to the NSA. They're relying on those sorts of orders to get this. And their analytic tools are probably, you know, way better than they were. I mean, because certainly ours are, and they're not going to be worse.
I mean, as you say in the, I think you say it in the book, or possibly you say it in the draft essay. It turned out that the security services were doing kind of what we all paranoically thought they might be doing. And so that's my, I guess that would be the question is like, what is the most paranoid fantasy we can come up with now about what the NSA can do?
Yeah, you know, I tend not to like to engage in that kind of extremist thinking. And it's something I did write in the essay. And it was interesting. I mean, 10 years ago, when we're seeing these NSA documents, like there's nothing in there that was surprising. Like if you had an NSA as a villain in a movie, this is exactly what they were doing. So it was on one hand, no surprise. On the other hand, it was really surprising to see the banal details of it all. But yeah, I mean, we could speculate on what they're doing today. I bet it's not that hard, you know, given a bunch of $1 billion budget and some, a lot of really smart people and motivation and time and bureaucracy, you could come up with some good stuff. The difference is going to be, and I don't know where it lands, is bulk surveillance versus targeted surveillance. Now, what our complaints were really 10 years ago was bulk surveillance. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a bad guy, you get a court order, you want to spy on them, that's okay. You know, we know how that works. That is lawful, and that is how crimes are solved. It's when you want to scoop up data on everybody looking for, you know, something, that's a general warrant, right? That is what is like in the Constitution. You're not allowed to do this.
Yeah, and bulk surveillance was not something that was really that usable or valuable earlier on because you didn't have a great way to analyze it. But now with the kind of computing technology that we have, and especially with AI, you can draw a lot from a little there.
Right. I mean, remember back then we were talking about hops, right? And the notion was you, people you talk to, people they talk to, people they talk to. And it turned out, you know, you get a few hops, you get a large net, but you rapidly get too many people to have to figure out, you know, who's in the conspiracy. But you're right. One of AI's powerful capabilities for large language models is summarization. I mean, it's not always perfect, but it's usually pretty good. And let's face it, human beings are not always perfect. And the ability to, at no cost, to summarize everything, right? Listen to everybody and send me a summary of the top 100 most interesting people. You could do that in a way that wasn't possible a few years ago. So this does make bulk collection more viable, right? Because you solve that, what used to be the bottleneck, which is the piece from the collection to the first level of interest. And once you get to the first level, you have human beings do the work to get the second, third level. But bulk to first level is very hard. And we would use keywords. We would use who you're talking to. Very crude measures. And now you can put more sophisticated smarts at that point.
You mentioned AI. The CEO of OpenAI, Sam Altman, just stated in a meeting that he feels that there needs to be an international agency like the International Atomic Energy Agency to oversee the regulation of AI.
So I basically agree with him. I think he's being disingenuous, he personally. I think he wants to get credit for saying these things, knowing they'll never happen. And if he starts saying, regulate me, it was like Zuckerberg saying the same thing a few years ago. You need to regulate me, right? Knowing full well that'll never happen. So he gets credit for wanting regulation. And also, you know, he knows that he's big enough that there is if there is regulation, it'll stifle the competition, not him. But he does have a point. You know, we are moving into an area where this technology is dangerous. And when we deal with dangerous technologies, whether they be nuclear energy or pharmaceuticals or airplanes or cars, we have very strict regulations. You can't just do what you want and throw it out there and let the market decide. And that's not the way pharmaceuticals work. That's not the way aircraft design works. And the reason is, if you get it wrong, it can kill people. And so we don't want that kind of experimentation. Computers are rapidly reaching that point. International, yes. Domestic, yes. I think we need more regulation here. I don't think we'll get it, at least in the U.S. But yeah, I think he's right.
This reminds me, I went through, I didn't reread all your books, but I reread all my book reviews.
It's a lot shorter. You could have had ChatGPT summarize it's shorter, that, you missed a
it's
trick.
It's shorter and it's quite evocative for me. And I came across this this quote that I put in the review of your 2018 book, Click Here to Kill Everybody. When the internet starts killing people, it will be regulated. And now you're saying that about AI, basically.
Yeah, and you know, in some ways, they're all munged together. You know, right? AI is, I think, largely a marketing term. So Internet of Things, what that book was really about was what happens when computers start affecting the world in a direct physical manner. The Internet of Things, right? Mm-hmm. Cars, medical devices, drones, right? Things that can harm you.
What I thought
AI is going to be the decision-making process in the background, right? But the real issue is going to be the actuators, the things that touch the world.
I wonder if you have run across a paper written by Madeline Claire Elish called Moral Crumple Zones. And
yes,
she presented it at We Robot in, I think, 2016. And it took her several years to get it published because it didn't fit into any obvious category. But the idea is that in a socio-technical system, in a human machine gestalt, it will be the human that is blamed. And we've already, when things go wrong, and we've already seen this when I think it was the Uber car that killed the pedestrian in Tempe, Arizona. First thing they said is it was the safety driver wasn't paying attention. And they went to great effort to try to prove that the safety driver was watching a movie on their phone or something.
You see this a lot in medical devices, mm-hmm. that if there is a medical device in a hospital and it kills a patient, the nurse is blamed, right? They are blamed. And it could be horrible user design. So there's one example where a radiation level is set with a toggle switch. You push down, it keeps going down. You push up, it keeps going up. Turns out if you push down too much, it cycles to the maximum. So the operator like pushed down five times instead of four times. Instead of the minimal dose, it was the maximal dose. The patient dies, and we blame the operator. We blame the nurse. Now, that is the proximal cause, but the real person to blame is whoever designed that horrible interface. And if you push the down button enough, you get to the top. Like, that's crazy design. But yes, I think we're seeing a lot of that, that the proximal human is getting the blame because we don't want to look at the system.
This makes me want to call Donald Norman the guru of design. I mean, one of the other reviews that I looked at was of Beyond Fear, which I have a note here, the 9/11 book.
Written, published in 2006, I think. Yeah, it was the 9/11 book.
Yeah. And you talk about systems failing at the seams and often people being the weakest link. And it doesn't really seem to me we've gotten much better at this, even though people have put a lot of money into studying.
I've thought a lot about that since then. I mean, people are the weakest link, but I think we design things so that the people are forced to be the weakest link. Mm-hmm. That we tend to cover up bad design by blaming the user. I mean, some examples are, think about the security advice we give people, right? Don't plug USB sticks into computers. Like, it's a USB stick. What are you supposed to do with it? Don't click on strange URLs. What am I supposed to do? It's a URL. How did we build a system where plugging a USB stick into a computer could be dangerous? Like, we do that, which is nutty. And then we blame the user for doing a perfectly reasonable thing. So yes, people are the weakest link, but we could do a lot better in designing systems so to scaffold their weaknesses instead of exacerbating them. So we end up giving, which is kind of advice that on the surface seems crazy. Like, why is it that I have to worry about a URL before I click on it? I don't have to worry about a book before I open it and read it. And I don't. It's not going to take over my laptop, right? That book is safe. But, on a Kindle, who knows?
I used to work for Angela Zassa, and of course she made her career saying exactly all of those things.
I just channeled her right there. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, it certainly sounded like her. All right, so do the spiel about your book.
Oh, wow. Hacker's Mind, we'll have two up. So by Pretty Cover, what I'm doing is I'm trying to extend the term hacking out of the computer field. Right. So think about the tax code. It's not computer code, but it's code, right? There are algorithms, there are inputs, there are outputs, there are formulas. And it has bugs, it has vulnerabilities. We call them tax loopholes. It has exploits. We call them tax avoidance strategies. It has black hats. We call them accountants. And it's the same basic idea that to me, a hack is something the system permits, but is unintended and unwanted by the designers. It's a mistake. Hacks follow the rules, but subvert their intent, right? A computer hack follows the rules of the code, but does something the programmers don't want the person to do, right? It's a mistake in programming or specification. A tax loophole is the same thing. It's not illegal, right? It's not tax evasion. It's tax avoidance. You're following the letter of the law, but breaking the spirit. So similarly, I look at things that hedge funds do. I look at politics and ways, things like the filibuster. Right? This isn't new. This is ancient Rome. It's like 50 BCE, and it's some senator. He's like reading the rules, or he's hearing them. I don't know if he's literate. And he notices that all business has to be conducted by sundown. That's the rule. He looks around and says, you know, if I never stop talking, we won't conduct any business. Right? And that was not the intent of the rule, but he found a hack. So gerrymandering is a hack. I talk about hacks in sports. Talk about hacks in, oh, airline frequent flyer programs. That was something we were all hacking in the 90s. There are ways to find these loopholes in the rules. And what's most fun about the book is the examples, right? I have hacks in religion, hacks in coming from fiction, from history. And we as a species do this. We look for ways to evade the rules by reading them very carefully and figuring out something that the rule writer missed.
I think you talk about sports, but if I'm right, I don't think you talk about doping, which is sort of the big sporting hack.
It is, yeah, I don't, because that really, you know, right? Doping is a hack, but then the rules are amended to prohibit the substance, and then it becomes a cheat. So yes, so there is a little arms race where the players are trying to find, like, reading the rules, what's prohibited. Oh yeah, they didn't mention that. Or if I change this particular molecule, this is no longer that and is no longer prohibited. So that does happen.
Yeah.
Sports is full of them, right? Because the rule books are incomplete. So my favorite is the 1970s. Someone shows up on the Formula One racetrack with a six-wheeled car. And everyone says, you can't have a six-wheeled car. And they pull out the rule book and say, show me. And it turns out the rules are silent on the number of wheels a car could have. Because who would occur to anybody that a car doesn't have four wheels? Now, what happens is that the rule book is then amended. If you read the rule book today, it'll say that a car can have no more or no less than, don't get any ideas, four wheels.
There was something like that in tennis, which is the only sport I know. I can't describe the pattern, but it was known as spaghetti string. And there was something about how somebody came up with a clever hack and how they strung their racket.
I remember that because, right, it evaded the rules, but still did the same thing that the rule was designed to prohibit.
I think that's right. And
that's not my book. That's a good one.
In the end, it was banned. Yeah.
Right, and that often happens. So another one, this is actually not in the book. I learned this a few weeks ago, that in the 18th century, there was a spate of random murders in Europe, mostly Northern Europe, weirdly, mostly Denmark. So here is the hack. You want to kill yourself. You want to commit suicide. The problem is, if you do so, you're going to hell. Right? You believe 100% suicide is a mortal sin, you're going to hell. So here is how you hack the system. You murder somebody. You will be arrested. You will be tried and convicted. You will be executed. But before you're executed, you can confess to a priest. I am not making this up. People would do this to end their life without having to go to hell for it.
The only way
the government solved this was by outlawing capital punishment. This was an actual problem.
It does seem to me like a very long, slow way of committing suicide, but then so is smoking, which Kurt Vonnegut once described as committing suicide by cigarette.
Yeah, but it's actually not that slow, right? You know, justice was swift and merciless back then.
Okay.
But it solves the problem of you don't get to go to heaven.
Well, that's if you think suicide should be a crime.
You know, I discovered an interesting hack on the service LinkedIn, where, you know, business people put their bios up there and try to say what they're doing and whatever their company is. And in LinkedIn, I was listed as chief operating officer and producer for Plutopia. And all of a sudden, I get all these obviously automated emails and with various names attached to them, and they're all coming from the same outfit, and they're trying to sell me on whatever their service is. They obviously have no idea what Plutopia is. So I changed the description. I didn't change the name of the company. I just said I was purchasing officer for medical devices. Immediately, I start getting emails soliciting medical devices. So they obviously have scrapers out there that go in and just harvest titles and email.
I wouldn't consider that a hack, right? Because I'm not sure what the subversion is. That feels like regular direct marketing to me.
Is spam a hack?
You know, it's an interesting question. So this is hard, and the book I spent some time on this. Like, what is in and what is out? Spam is a subversion of email, right? Only works because the cost of sending email is close to free. But, you know, yeah, I'm trying to walk this line in the book. If everything is a hack, the book is useless. If nothing is a hack, then it's also useless. So I really want to make it following the letter of the rules, but subverting the spirit, right? Spam email does that. That kind of direct marketing based on keywords kind of does it. But I'll give you an interesting hack I heard yesterday by someone who does have a podcast. So he has a podcast and he sets it up, I think, on... I forget which site. Let's say it's on YouTube, but I don't know if it is. And he needs engagement. He needs people to respond to it. He finds that if he puts typos in the text, people will comment to correct his typos. That counts as more engagement, and more people see his podcast.
Oh, we're going to use that.
That's totally a hack. Well, which is super clever.
I feel a campaign coming on already. Yeah. I was raised by it.
Just don't misspell my name and you're fine.
Or mispronounce it.
Everybody mispronounces it. I always tell them Schneier rhymes with frequent flyer.
I want to know about cognitive hacks. How do you hack cognition?
So this is an extension of the idea, right? Because I'm talking about systems of rules. And I do think norms fall carry here, that not necessarily formal rules, they could be informal rules. So there are social hacks that hack informal rules. Donald Trump hacked a whole bunch of our informal rules around politics. But I do think that our cognitive systems evolved in a certain environment for certain purposes, and they can be subverted. That our notions of fear, of authority, of attention, of engagement, are deliberately subverted by a lot of modern technology. I mean, terrorism, I think, hacks fear. I've been saying that, you know, a decade before that. Said that in my 9/11 book, right? You know, like decade before I'm writing about this. That these systems are, you know, have these, and it's hard to use the right language because, you know, there's no designer. There's no creator. They have evolved, but they evolved in an environment to do a task. I mean, there's a reason that we have feelings of authority as humans, as mammals. But that can be subverted by someone who wants to take advantage of us. And I think of those as cognitive hacks.
Well, this is like London in the 70s and 80s when the IRA was active. You know, the whole goal of the thing wasn't necessarily to blow something up, is to make people frightened.
And it was almost genteel, right? They plant a bomb and then call you and say, "Hey, I planted a bomb. You might want to leave the building." Yeah. I mean, it's like it almost seems quaint today, but yes, right. The goal was fear, to make you fearful and to feel powerless and to feel the government couldn't protect you.
Yeah. So Antifa is a hack, right? I mean, this idea, this concept of Antifa that they keep tossing out is to create a fear of something that really doesn't exist in any formal or organized way.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know if that's a hack or just straight propaganda. But yes,
Well, is propaganda a hack? I guess that's another question.
Yeah, so this gets wind. If everything's a hack, nothing's a hack, right? Yeah. So you know, I'm already at the edge, and I'm afraid to tip over, you know, tip my toe over. Yeah. Bruce, I want it to be a subversion of a set of rules.
Bruce, did you ever read C.S. Lewis's That Hideous Strength?
I did not. I've read some Lewis, but not that book.
There's a great scene in it where this guy who has kind of given in to the forces of evil is consciously writing propaganda for a publication in various locations. And, you know, it's really fascinating to read because it's a very good depiction of the style of these various tabloids and broadsheet newspapers.
But I do write a lot about religious hacks. Religions are hacked all the time, and not just that example of you know, killing someone to get out of going to hell. I grew up Jewish, and Judaism is full of hacks. Right?
Yes. I
mean, ways that you follow the rules but subvert their intent. So, you know, my cousins were Orthodox. I was not. But they would have the television on a timer so they could watch the hockey games. And there were these tricks all these tricks involved in being able to do things on the Sabbath that you weren't allowed to do because, and I guess God is easily fooled. I don't know why it works. Or the Erev, right? The unbroken wire around entire neighborhoods that technically make the neighborhood a household. So you can carry things, even though you can't carry things outside your home.
London has an Erev that is 11 miles long.
Right.
But the other thing I was going to ask you, the paranormal investigator, James Randi, I was visiting him once, and he showed me his refrigerator. And it turns out that
this is going to be a great story, I can tell.
A lot of the refrigerators in his area of Florida don't turn on the light on Saturdays.
Right.
They have a Sabbath mode that mm-hmm. is actually built into the refrigerator, and you have to call an engineer to disable it.
And I remember in Jerusalem,
you can open your refrigerator. So you can open your refrigerator on Saturday because the light won't come on.
Right, and there are hotels in Jerusalem that on Sabbath would stop at every floor on the way up and on the way down.
Right,
so you can walk into the elevator. It's all happening automatically. You're not doing the work. Right, you are passive.
I was visiting a friend in DC once, and it was daylight, and the light was on. So I reached up to turn it off, and he goes, "No, my God, we can't turn it back on." And I'm sort of sitting there thinking, you know, if you're supposed to sit in the dark, then you should sit in the dark and suffer. Come on,
right?
And I said, "Well, I can turn it back on." And he said, "What was your mother?" I said, "My mother was not Jewish." And he said, "Oh, all right then. Yes, you can turn it off."
But he can't ask you to. But he can say it's a little dark in here.
But he did beg me.
Of hair splitting is amazing.
It seems like a good way to keep God really busy.
This is why Jews make good lawyers.
It is why Jews make good lawyers, right? We are constantly rules lawyering. You know, same thing happens when you play D&D.
He did beg me not to turn off the light in the bathroom, which had no windows.
I mean, playing D&D is the same thing. You're constantly rules lawyering.
I'm just kind of baffled by the idea of a God that spends this much time sweating all these little details, you know?
You know, but in Judaism, it's really less about God and more about, you know, we are the people who do the thing. It's more about social signaling. It's more about us versus them. You know, it's not a religion in the same way that some of the proselytizing religions are. Mm-hmm. Like, Judaism cares less about what you believe, more about what you do. But we're getting far afield.
Yeah,
it's true.
You consider the militarization of that fine little toy, the drone, the little things that used to be kids' toys. Now they're carrying weapons. Would you consider that a hack?
I would not consider that a hack. I think, like, as soon as anything is invented in the history of ever, someone looks at it and says, you know, can I eat it? Can I get drunk with it? Can I make weapon out of it? I mean, that's what we do. So I would not think of that as a hack.
There's a fourth thing. Can I put it on my head? Have my hair grow more?
I
I mean, I swear to God, if there is a substance in the world, somebody has put it on their hair.
I thought you were going to say, could you have sex with it? Which I suppose is also a fourth thing.
My question is it evolution or is it a hack? I mean, some things are just innovation, evolution, hack. Right. I mean, it's all about.
And hacking is a form of evolution.
Yeah.
That in a lot of ways, hacking a system is a way to get the system to do a new thing that we want it to do. You know, it's hard to change systems. You know, we're learning that today in politics. It's much easier to look at the system, find a loophole, right, have it become the new normal, and move forward from there. So, I mean, the example I use in my book is trespass law, which was kind of invented as a hack of English common law, and is now, you know, standard jurisprudence. But at the time, it was a unintended, unanticipated reading of an old law in this new way. So hacking is not necessarily bad. Largely it is. Largely is the rich and powerful taking advantage of systems. But occasionally it is the less powerful trying to, you know, survive in the face of systems where the world is just stacked against them.
You know, one review I read of your book called out the sort of helplessness it was making the reviewer feel.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
With this onslaught of all these different hacks and the fact that the most effective and powerful hacks could only be created by people who are rich and powerful, or could be bought by people who are rich and powerful.
Right. Or they're taken advantage of, right? So, like, you know, if you invent a new tax loophole, it is likely going to be, like, declared illegal by tax court. And even if it wasn't, you're going to save, I'm going to make this up, $1,000, $10,000. Goldman Sachs discovers a tax loophole, they make billions. And they have lobbyists to make sure that that loophole stays legal. And it's like 20 years later and the carried interest loophole is still here. So yes, the rich and powerful are better at finding them, taking advantage of them, and ensuring that they stay open.
The hack, I was a little surprised. I didn't see it. Maybe you'll tell me it's there in the book. Is Richard Stallman's general public license, which was a very clever hack of copyright.
Yeah, I didn't have it in the book. That would be a good example, right? Because he's subverting copyright law.
Yeah.
He's taking the law and moving it. And that's a good example of a beneficial hack. I got to remember that one. It's a good example.
Yeah, I mean, basically what he used copyright law to set stuff free and ensure that it stay free.
I know, it's great. I mean, it really was clever.
It actually, that is the brilliant thing he did. I know everybody talks about new Emacs with great reverence, but honestly, the copyright thing I think is more significant.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good example. It's not in my book. I didn't think of it.
Yeah. So among the other bits of pieces I found from reading my own book reviews, what I think of is the Snowden book, which is Data and Goliath in 2015. You suggested breaking up the NSA. Do you still think that's a good idea?
You know, I do. And I'm trying to remember what I said. Back then I said three parts. Let's see if I can remember it. Let's see if you remember it. So I do think that, you know, separating Cyber Command doing military things. I know what it was. It was separating espionage, right? You know, state-on-state espionage, right? Spying on the president of a foreign country. That's its own thing. From NSA on population surveillance, that they're really doing at the behest of the FBI, right? For law enforcement purposes. And then the third thing was the defensive arm. Those are very different roles. They're complementary in tech, but they're very contradictory in authority. And having them under one roof, I think, is dangerous for society. Now, since then, CISA has taken over a lot of the defense in the United States. You know, NSA still does defense, and I'd like to see that separated. It's kind of moved into DHS, into CISA. But I do want to see that, you know, espionage separated from surveillance for law enforcement purposes. That they are different enough legally that having the same entity to do them both is dangerous. How'd I do? Did I get that right?
I don't know.
It's been a long time.
The review was not that detailed. but I think that's kind of what they've done. They've done a little bit of that in the UK, in that the GCHQ yes. has kind of spun off the National Cybersecurity Center,
right?
To do defensive advice.
And that makes sense, because you're not going to trust the defensive advice from an agency who also wants to spy on you.
No,
you're just not. Because you know they have a hidden agenda. And you really need someone you can trust. This is just too important, you know, not to have it being done by someone who's trusted.
It's too bad that governments, ours anyway, don't have a real ombudsman, I can't even say it, that is there only to help the populace.
Right.
Not to spy on it, not to give it bad advice, but just to say, okay, this has happened to you. We'll give you good advice on how to
overcome that. And this is the fundamental dilemma, right? That one world, one internet, one answer. You know, either we create the protocol so that everyone gets to spy, or no one gets to spy. You know, I can't create an internet where the good guys can spy and the bad guys can't. Right? I mean, there's no way to set the tech up so it operates differently depending on the moral stance of the operator, right? I mean, I just can't do that. You know, and I know I've said this in some book, that we need to adopt the defense dominant strategy. The defense has to win. It is now way too important and too critical that we can't build this stuff insecure so that the good guys can do the spying.
Is that where you get into talking about red teaming?
Yeah, what about it?
Oh, I was just wondering, I mean, how do we actually determine what our defenses are?
Yeah, you know, I think red teaming is valuable. I talk about it in terms of hacking also. I would love to see, I mean, just like we do security audits of software before we release it to the public, can we do an audit of a tax legislation and say, you know, where are the potential hacks? You know, how can we patch them before we vote on this law? That might be
don't
a
you
good
think
thing.
One of the big problems, don't you think one of the big problems is misplaced incentives? You know, it does often seem to me if we analyzed incentives better, and that's what the workshop for economics of information security is about too.
I mean, you're 100% right. I mean, that incentives are at the heart of a lot of our issues. Our tech problems are rarely technological; they are most often incentives. Right? Who has the incentive to stop spam? Who has the incentive to close tax loopholes?
And this
why are phones so insecure? Well, because the incentive is to make them easier to use, which has a side effect of insecurity. So you get insecurity. But yeah, economic incentives, I think, are very important in all of these conversations.
But that's the thing we were talking about with the government before, too. The government has less incentives to stop data collection on the part of commercial companies.
That's
because
right.
They don't have to do it with commercial companies. They don't have to do it themselves. They don't have to have a public debate. They don't have to deal with the outrage. And they can subpoena the data when they want it.
Right. They use it, too.
Right.
So it'd be hard to get a government to
budget.
Yeah. I mean, you're 100% right. And politicians use it. I mean, you know, politicians like Facebook targeted ads. They're not going to outlaw them. They use them in elections all the time.
Yeah, they do. That's a hack I meant to mention to you. You may not know that when abortion was legalized in the UK, it was the right was never extended to Northern Ireland. And this only finally happened a few years ago because the Republic of Ireland voted to legalize it. And there is a minister there who will not set up clinics. So even though it's now legal, there's no access.
Wow. Right. And that's that kind of, you know, bureaucratic hacking.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's legal, but we're going to make it onerous.
Yeah.
So you'll hear that talk about the United States in terms of administrative burdens. That, you know, you are legally allowed this service, this benefit, but we're going to make it so hard for you to claim it
right.
that you don't get it.
Yeah, yes, that's how they're hacking the vote here in the U.S. There's many places where they're making it so hard to vote that people just aren't going to vote.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of examples of this kind of thing in the book. You know, things, I think one of your examples was welfare payments, wasn't it? Where it's very, very difficult to sign up for them.
There's an entire book on this. I think it's called Administrative Burden, and talks about how, you know, these burdens are so onerous for, you know, the poor who are already overworked. The very people that the law is intended to help, these burdens are put in place so the law doesn't actually help them. And there are some people who think that's a benefit. I mean, this is not like uniformly decried as a bad thing. Some people think this is a great idea.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, middle class people don't realize how much work it is to be poor.
That is true. That is 100% true.
Yeah.
Everything is harder.
Yes. I mean, I should hasten to add, I have never really been poor, but I read a lot, and particularly on Twitter, or when I used to read a lot on Twitter. Twitter is not Twitter anymore, as we know.
No, Twitter will rot your brain. Don't read that stuff.
Actually,
I worked with people who were poor a lot.
Up until last November, I would really disagree with you. Twitter was invaluable during the acute stage of the pandemic because I could read all these medical experts. I mean, genuine experts who were posting in the public interest.
Yeah, I've never been a social media person. I'm on no social media. It makes me a freak, but highly productive. So I'm probably not the right person to ask because I am definitely Three Sigma. I've never been on Twitter, I've been on Facebook or Instagram or any of those. I once had a LiveJournal account. That's how far back my social media cred goes.
I had a LiveJournal account. I still have it. I can't actually delete it or do anything with it because somehow the password has either been changed or
yeah, we all had a LiveJournal account.
No longer control the email address that's associated with that account, and if you've lost that, you can't do anything. You can't change the password and gain access.
All right. So is this a hack? When Russia bought Twitter, right? A lot of Russian dissidents are on Twitter.
Russia never bought Twitter. Mm-hmm. Russia bought LiveJournal.
LiveJournal. Yeah, I meant LiveJournal.
Yeah.
So right, a bunch of Russian dissidents are on LiveJournal. This is where they're communicating, and instead of like hacking them, like getting into their network, they buy the company. So suddenly, your entire history is now owned by the Russians. I thought that was a super clever move. Scary as hell, but super clever.
Well, I mean, Elon Musk wanted to change Twitter and he bought the damn thing, you know.
That's a really expensive vanity project, but...
Yeah, especially its value keeps shrinking.
Well, it's hard to understand what the incentive was there.
I think he was just annoyed.
The incentive was that he made a rash decision on impulse and then got stuck with it because they wouldn't let him back out without paying $1 billion.
I think that's
you
right.
You know, it's really,
nobody actually
I mean,
wanted to. And it turns out paying $1 billion to back out would have been a bargain.
Well, it's hard to reconcile his purchase of Twitter and what he's done with it so far with the supposition that he's a genius of some kind.
It doesn't feel like genius behavior. I don't buy into that supposition.
Well, I didn't really either. So we just shot it down.
But for about 5 to 10 years, Twitter was a source of endless, really interesting things. And for journalists, Twitter was great because...
Yeah, I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that. I mean, I was never on it, but I know a lot of people who are.
The kind of work I do... It was incredibly useful to have people sort of posting curated links of things that I should be reading.
Aren't they still, I mean, there's still a lot of people who have just kind of soldiered on with Twitter. And then there's some that have gone to Mastodon and some that have gone to, what is it, Post?
Blue Sky's picking people up.
Yeah.
More of the people who interest me have gone to Mastodon. Post, I don't think Post is going to be successful.
No, I don't either. Blue Sky might. Blue Sky appears to be getting some traction now, but it's like slow growth mode.
I haven't seen it. They haven't. I've signed up for an invitation, but never got one.
Yeah, until you get the invitation, it's going to be an obscure thing, and there is a relatively slow growth, but it's hit a point of. I guess a turning point where it started to have a lot more activity and be more interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a matter of who survives. We've had these things happen before with applications and with companies. You get a bunch of people doing the same thing and having the same goal, and there could, it's the kind of like the Highlander thing, there can only be one. And
yeah, the network effects. I mean, the wealth goes to the wealthy, and because the value of being on a network depends on who else is on the network. So eventually, you know, a Facebook or emerges as the one.
Yeah, that's what you saw with Mastodon. Mastodon started to be valuable when many people started moving there from Twitter. And Blue Sky is starting to be valuable as more and more people are getting those codes and getting into the system.
To be fair, Mastodon was successful for a relatively small number of people for quite some time. I mean, my account is 5 years old.
But how many people that you knew and wanted to interact with could you really access through Mastodon until recently?
Not many until last November, and then all of a sudden they started flooding in and it became more useful.
We ought to start thinking of ways to hack these systems, I guess. Bruce, before we drop off, and I know we're running low on time, I'm just wondering if you believe that artificial intelligence will be used to hack artificial intelligence.
So I believe we'll use to hack everything. And I kind of end my book with these chapters. The idea of finding a hack is a human creative process. I mean, looking at the law and figuring out a loophole and figuring out a way to subvert intent. But I think it is a process that AIs will increasingly be able to do. And, you know, I can imagine feeding an AI the entire nation's tax code and saying, find me some loopholes. And a human creative process that maybe takes years or months gets compressed to minutes or seconds. And it finds what? 10, 100, 1,000. And that's going to be really, really different. And I don't know if our systems can survive that kind of loophole finding. I think it will happen, not soon. You know, if I was Goldman Sachs, I would be trying to do this. I would be feeding it financial regulations and saying, find me loopholes, find me tricks, find me things I haven't thought of, things the regulators haven't thought of. Find me these things that are profitable. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens when that happens.
Have you encountered Janelle Shane?
I'm sorry?
Have you encountered Janelle Shane?
I have not.
She's somebody I found on Twitter. She has written a book called "You Look Like a Thing and I Love You."
Yes, I know the book, I know the person, the work.
Yeah, yep. I mean, some of the stuff that she does tell stories of AI. The AI wouldn't say the AI hacked the system because the AI isn't conscious, but it has answered things in an unexpected and subversive
way. So you a lot written about this. This is, and it's called reward hacking in the AI community, right? It's achieving a goal in the way the designers didn't intend or anticipate. And there are examples. I mean, there are a few examples used in my book. One, trying to remember, it's an evolution simulation, right? And the goal is to cross a distant finish line. And you expect that the AI is to get more legs or bigger muscles or longer legs. And one of the AIs figures out if it grows really tall, it could fall over the line faster than anybody can run.
Right? That's in her book.
Right?
Yeah.
Or there's a someone programming the robot vacuum cleaner not to bump into things. And instead of learning not to bump into things, it learns to drive backwards because there are no bumper sensors in the rear. Right. So these are hacks.
Yeah.
Right? It's subverting systems. And I think it's really interesting to think about this.
But it's not because it wants to subvert the system. It's because
it just doesn't know what the system is.
It's solving the problem it was set.
Right. And the goal is insufficiently constrained. So that's meeting the goal in a way you didn't intend. It's another one that had to do with a game that the computer was playing that involves driving a boat around and getting points by doing things. And the AI figures out if it spins the boat around really fast, it gets a lot of points. Like, it wasn't supposed to do that.
No.
But you know, it figures out the ways, it figures out the loopholes in the rules because it doesn't understand what a loophole is. It all it sees is the rules.
Yeah. Which reminds me that in response to Nick Bostrom's thing about optimizing something for to make paper clips and wiping out the human race.
Which I'm less worried about.
Yeah, I'm less worried about that too. But what I was leading up to was the science fiction writer Charlie Strauss's response to that, which is that we have AIs. They're old, slow AIs. We call them corporations.
Yeah. And that's an interesting point raised, that these are rule optimization machines.
Yeah. They are, you know, they're optimized for very specific things, profits and shareholder returns.
Yep. That's right.
And
specialized AIs. Do you think we'll have a general AI? You decided not to focus on that in the
book. Me, not in my lifetime. I mean, you know, we'll get them in the movies constantly, but that's very much, you know, our fantasy. No, I don't. And I don't think we're pushing towards that. The specialized ones are much easier and more profitable and more useful. So no, I'm not worried about generalized AI.
Neither am I, you know, but I run into people all the time who insist that I'm an idiot about this, you know. But
that's because you're running into them. You should watch where you're going.
Well, well, they're usually on Dave Farber's weekly call. It's the problem. But, you know, every time I read about the idea of a superhuman consciousness, my inner biological supremacist comes out.
No, I don't worry about that. I don't have a biological supremacist, but yes, I don't think it's anytime soon.
If at all.
You know, if at all is a long time horizon. Not willing to say that. Right? Forever is a long time.
I think regardless whether we have a general AI or not, it will not be like a human intelligence.
It will not be like what we see in the movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the things we see in the movies are usually designed to aid the special effects people in central casting.
Well, I mean, more important, they reflect the present. Science fiction reflects the present. It doesn't reflect the future. It's always about the present.
And there's a lot of black boxes in science fiction.
And a lot of black boxes in my car.
There you are. I am seeing that we are almost at the end of the hour. What have we not addressed? Wendy, what else did you hope to ask Bruce?
I think I covered most of the things in my notes. I did want to mention that I thought you mentioned Theranos in the book, you know, the fraudulent company for which Elizabeth Holmes has just gone to prison. But it did strike me that the big hack was really not the fraud of the product, but the recruitment of very rich, powerful men who had absolutely no medical knowledge to the board to give it the veneer of respectability.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a time-honored business practice to bring in attractive folks, regardless of whether they have any impact on the business.
Yeah, I mean, the board included people like Henry Kissinger and George Shultz and, you know, people, big names with absolutely no medical expertise whatsoever.
Right, but impeccable reputations. Well, you know,
Kissinger. Some of them.
Never mind.
Yeah, Henry Kissinger.
Who are famous.
Yeah, who were famous and, you know, for some reason respected. But that, I think we got through pretty much everything in my notes. But I will thank you for drawing my attention to the great quote from Julie Cohen. Power interprets regulation as damage and roots around it.
Julie Cohen's book is great.
What is the book?
Between Truth and Power.
Between Truth and Power.
Yeah.
And it's you know, it's an academic press. It's not an easy read, but it's a good read.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Bruce, so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.